Welcome, everyone, to On the First Tee. My name is Ian Butcher.
And I'm Ben Matthews, and this is the podcast where we go behind the scenes of golf.
Well, Ben, for this week, I took it upon myself, because you were traveling, to interview Mike McKenna, who is the general manager and the course manager for Amateur Spring Country Club in Thailand. And Mike O'Keefe, our good friend, Mike O'Keefe from Ohio State International internship program, also joined us as well. And what a hoot we had, really, just listening to Mike talk about his career journey.
Yes, I was away to Western New York, to Buffalo, to be exact, to go see my beloved Buffalo Bills play. Go Bills. And of course, engage in the tailgate experience, which is an American experience unto itself. But the podcast with Mike McKenna, I've had a chance to listen to it a few times now. An incredible career journey. Really gutted that I missed that one. And I also just wanted to thank Mike O'Keefe for doing a bang up job for stepping in for me. So Mike, you got to come back and do that again for us.
Well, he is our voice of America, isn't he, in a very positive way. And so it's Mike knows these guys from the internship program. Mike McKenna himself is a graduate of the Ohio State internship program. And that's what we wanted to touch base with Mike about, is what has his career, you know, unfolded. And Ben, I mean, literally, you know, we always start with every guest. We always start, you know, can you just tell us about, you know, how you got started and what your career is been like? And well, that was 1 hour 10 minutes, you know, so he's still on that, and we didn't actually get to the full end of it. Actually, we're gonna have to bring Mike back, I think, to find out exactly what he's doing at Amateur Spring as a venue. But just listening to all the places he's been to and all the adventures he's had, you know, through this wonderful career of golf, it's inspiring to listen to him talk. And then, of course, you've got Mike O'Keefe there, who's one of those people who's on the journey, who's supporting him.
Yeah, I've had an opportunity to listen to the episode a few times as I've gone through and started editing it. It's one of those stories, Mike McKenna, that, again, it is, look, if you'd said to me as a young guy, do you want to travel the world, be involved in a sport, and get paid for it? And he's lived it. He's gone all over the world. He's honed his craft. And look at where he is now. I mean, as far as geographically, beautiful spot there in Thailand, but also where he is in his career. So, look, if you want to travel the world, folks, consider the golf industry.
That's right. And I think just one last comment about the two of them, really, that they were sending out a message. Two things, really, to take from me were, one, you know, be prepared to leave your hometown. You know, be prepared to explore the world. And secondly, have a great work ethic. And if you've got that, then people will support you along the way. And, you know, so listen to this podcast if you're a young person and you're not sure, you know, what the potential is out there to travel and work at the same time. And even listen to this if you're a parent and you want to share it with your children about, you know, how this golf industry creates exciting opportunities. Enjoy this podcast. Welcome, everybody, to today's episode of On the First Tee. We today are talking to Mike McKenna, the general manager and the course manager of Amateur Spring Country Club in Bangkok, Thailand, and Mike O'Keefe, who is the director of the Ohio State internship program. Ben Matthews can't be with us today, so Mike O'Keefe's filling in for him. And yeah, Mike, I'm gonna say one thing before we start talking to Mike. Is that I was playing with three head greenkeepers last week, Mike, and they'd all been on the Ohio State internship program, and they'd all said it was the best thing they had done for their careers, and they were unanimous in that. And I'm gonna just get that plug out of the way right at the very start, okay? And then we can turn our attention to Mike. So yes, we're just gonna talk to you, Mike, because you've got a very, if you don't mind me saying so, you've got a very interesting role right now, which touches on the podcast themes of what can you do in golf, and then also what's it like working out there. So, yeah, if it's okay, I'll just start by asking, Mike, you know, how did you get involved in golf right from the get-go? What attracted you? Were you a player? Were you playing? And what was your first jobs in golf industry?
For me, I had multiple things going on. My school bag had cricket bats. It had tennis rackets. I played football, and it kind of came down to around about 15. I think it was the summer holidays, and there was a promotion on at the local golf club, which is like 300 yards from my parents' house. Yeah, Tyneside Golf Club, which was right next to my mother's house, and I played the summer there, and that was it. My cricket went, the tennis went. I still played football, but that was it. It was probably 94, 95.
Fantastic. Yeah, and then your first job?
Yeah, I kind of worked in the pro shop a little bit. I did the 1996 Compaq European Tour event at Slaley Hall as a volunteer. I think Retief Goosen won. And I was playing golf then. I was pretty good back then. I remember watching Retief Goosen play with that unbelievable tempo in the swing. You know, went home, played golf that night, shot 68, was wanting to become a professional golfer. And quickly realized that wasn't going to happen. But my first job was kind of working in the pro shop, 95, and then, started getting into tournament volunteering in 96. I didn't start in on the industry until about 1998, I would say, was my first job as a greenkeeper, as an apprentice greenkeeper at the same golf club, Tyneside Golf Club. That was my first job.
Fantastic. So you got a lot of experience in the back there. Now, I don't know whether I want to move to this straight away, Mike, because I just think your role is fascinating for us. You are the general manager and the director of agronomy at your club in Thailand, Annathaya?
Amata Spring Country Club.
Amata, thank you, Mike. I can see a lot of people listening or hear a lot of people listening saying, what a role I would like. Because one of the issues we're addressing in the podcast is this conflict exists between course managers and their committees. You seem to have cut through all of that and just said, no, I'm just going to, take it all. Yeah? Is that how it is?
Yeah, I mean.
Is it the best job in the world?
It's not easy. You have conversations with yourself. I want a tractor. You cannot have one. Can I have a fairway mower? I know you're not having that either. So I'm a little bit of a schizophrenic. It's not easy. And I think I've just been blessed of working through all my career, working with exceptional people and having an experience. It's some of the best clubs in the world that kind of prepared me for that. I also helped my father's business out, so I ran my father's business when he got ill. So I kind of step by step, I'd kind of grown into a position where, because I got the golf background, I kind of understand the member's point of view, the golfer point of view. And then obviously you have the agronomy point of view. And you're always trying to mix the two together. Which obviously has its moments, but at the end of the day, and all the course managers are going to dislike me at this, but the golfers pay your wages, and they keep the club moving. So you have to have that perspective. That's why we're here. That's why we're working so hard. And ultimately, all them hours we're putting in is to prepare a golf course for them. So surely we should be putting their interests at the forefront of any decision. But I've been lucky enough to have had a career where I've been able to see both sides of the coin a lot. And I think that prepared me well for the role. My chairman, who moved me into the role, said, the first board meeting you ever did, I knew you were capable. So that was always good. And when you've got the support of your chairman, it makes a big difference.
But Ian, I think it's important to actually go back and figure out how he got to where he is today. So maybe you can tell us, Mike. I remember talking to you when you were a 19-year-old lad.
Yeah, I remember that. I was, I was at Tyneside then, and I was always looking for the next step. I'm a very analytical thinker. My father, when I told him I was going to go into greenkeeping, it was a dreaded phone call. And he just said, what's the plan for the next 5 years? And I kind of laid it out for him. And he paused for a second and he said, well, I know you've thought it through. He said, so whatever you need, I'm here to support. And my plan was always to get to Slaley Hall. They were doing the the European Tour events. And but also I'd looked at the Ohio State program as I'd went to America multiple times when I was younger, and it's something that interested me, but it just wasn't the right time. And I think everything happens for a reason, and at that point in my career I decided to stick out in my apprenticeship. And I stayed at Tyneside. I then went to Slaley Hall within a year and a half of me starting in the industry, which was great because it exposed me to high-end European Tour events. We were doing two a year with the seniors. The start was quick, and you had to learn on your feet. But I think the difference is in the UK is that we kind of do that apprenticeship where you're doing the practical stuff and then you go into doing your theory. It's quite the opposite in America, and I'm sure we can get into that a little bit. But the start of my career was Tyneside, worked for a wonderful man who's no longer with us, David Simpson, who passed away a couple of years ago. I used to go back every year to go and see him because he instilled the work ethic that got me to where I was, because ultimately, as I made them transitions across the world, the work ethic was the biggest thing. You know, you got to work hard in this industry. So, I think that was the beginning.
And you went from there on to Slaley and then up to Loch Lomond, because I heard of you again up in Loch Lomond. Is that right?
Yeah. So I was lucky enough to go up to Loch Lomond. I'll tell the story. My boss at the time spoke to me. I was working at a place called Hexham Golf Club, which is a great place. I'm actually going up there tomorrow. And the boss came up to me and he said, "You know what, Michael, you were the best decision I ever made hiring you here as my assistant. I'm looking forward to retiring in 15 years' time and knowing that you're going to be the one taking over from me." And I was gone within a month after he said that to me because he made me realize that I ain't sitting for 15 years because, again, in this country, not a lot of the head greenkeepers move on. You know, they're going to stay there until the retirement. But it frightened the life out of me. And then so I looked, and the Scottish Open was something I watched every year. Loch Lomond, beautiful golf course, and was very lucky to go up there initially as a summer intern. And I took a 50% pay cut to go up to Loch Lomond. And I would say that's where it all started. And as I said to you, things happen for a reason. You know, not a lot of people are going to take a 50% pay cut. But when I did that 50% pay cut, it exposed me to some great people at Loch Lomond Golf Club. And ironically, a guy from Ohio State, from Scioto Country Club, Seth Rainier. So that's kind of where the reignition of me going to the U.S. was. When I was kind of rooming with Seth, and I realized that the study work, the plant pathology work, was way ahead of anything we had in the UK. And that really sparked my interest for that next stage in my career.
Yeah, and Ian, he was there rooming with this young man from Ohio State I'd sent over to Loch Lomond. And the penny dropped, and he realized that depth that it was involved. And actually, Seth called me up on the phone and said, "I've got a guy here that I think should go on the program." And then he confessed to me that he talked to me 9 years earlier, but just didn't make it to push the button to come on the program. And I said, "Well, you're never too late." I think you were like 27 or 28 at this stage, you know. But I want to make the point there, Ian, to your listeners. Did you hear him say he took a 50% pay cut?
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that people don't do today. But having that insight and having that gravitas to go and say, "I'm going to go to a course and a you know, in Scotland, and it's a tournament course, and I'm not worried about the money." And this is something important for young people if they're listening. It's not about the money at that stage in your career. Go to work for good mentors. Go to work for good courses, because you're going to be surrounded by good people.
Yeah, no, it's not easy. I had to get some support from my father with that, taking a 50% pay cut. You know, I had bills to pay. But it was more to enhance my career. I knew down the line it would help me that I would go and work at Loch Lomond. And remember, when I took the job, I had no idea about the Ohio State connection or anything like that. Right. This was purely for me to go and work with some of the best people, you know, looking at how good Loch Lomond was.
Was it Ken Seams that was there then, Mike? Was it Ken?
No, Ken had left. But I met Ken down the road later. He's a great guy. And it was David Cole who was there.
David Cole.
When I was at Loglund.
Well, he's very busy. Do you know what he's doing right now? He's very, very busy right now. I look out my window and there's about 3 miles away. I can see the pile of sand that he's sand capping the new course in St. Andrews. He's buried in sand. I can see him from here. It's a fantastic project. Mike, I was interrupting because you're right about that. I wanted to go back to the comment about the 5-year plan, because I wonder how many of our listeners actually sit down with a pen and paper and come up with a 5-year plan. So Mike, can I ask the question, was the plan realized, you know, absolutely as you planned, or did you adapt the plan as you move through it?
Well, the 5-year plan was get to Slaley Hall, you know, right, because that's where the European Tour event was. So I had to adapt it. So that was, you know, I've got to Slaley Hall. I actually just went to close house because the first assistant at Slaley Hall when I was there is the superintendent at close house, which had the British Masters. So I went to see him yesterday with my family and talk about the old times, because that group of people we had at Slaley Hall, all of them went on to be either assistant superintendents or head greenkeepers for your listeners. And we had a real strong group of people, and you had to be on your toes because it was a volatile environment. If you weren't on, you know, your lines weren't straight, right, or, you know, you did something wrong, you heard about it for a month. So again, it was a great place to go, but I evolved that plan to say, right, I've got here now, I've got this experience going. Now I need to be a senior greenkeeper. Now I need to be, you know, an assistant greenkeeper. So I got to senior at Slaley Hall. Then I had a chance to move across because there was a construction going on at Martfin Hall. And then ultimately going to Hexham was to take on an assistant head greenkeeper role. So, yeah, it moved quickly.
Very good.
But I had to adapt it. But you've got to keep looking at that. You've got to look down the line in front of you.
Yeah, it's brilliant insight. And the Americans always talk about it, Mike. They always say you've got to have a plan, you know, and you've got to tell people what that plan is. Yeah. But I get a feeling some young people are scared to write down a plan because they think, oh, that ties me. That ties me. And I just want to hear from you there that no, it doesn't tie you. You can change the plan, but do have one.
You got to have goals and objectives and to get up every day. But Mike, tell us about then when you got to America, what did you do?
I'm going to give you an insight in my first day at Scioto Country Club. So I go into Scioto Country Club and I sit down and I get this big folder and it's like the Scioto way. So I read this huge folder, SOP, stuff like that, you know, what we do here, everything else. So my boss at the time, Mr. Bob Becker, says, you, again, Mike, but he called me Michael the entire time and still does to this day, calls me Michael. He's like, Michael, have you finished reading that? I'm like, yes, sir. He goes, right, come in here. So I go in his office. He looks down my CV. At this point on my CV, I've done the Benson Hedges at the Belfry, the Scottish Open, 15 to 20 European Tour events on my CV. And I'll never forget his face. He quickly scanned it and he said, yeah, it looks like you know what you're doing, but that's worthless here. I'm like, okay. He's like, here you do it the Scioto way. And I'm like, okay, I think I understand. He said, we've been perfecting this for 14 years since I've been here. He said, so you got two options. He said, number one is you follow everything that we tell you to do and you do it the way we want it to be done. I'm like, okay. He said, number two is if you think there's a better way, no problem. You come and speak to me. We might do a trial or see something. He says, but that's how it's done here. And I'm like, okay, sir, no problem. So I went out to work and I was, I think, 45 minutes into my first job and I see him coming over the hill on the cart. I'm like, oh, no, what have I done? So he pulls up. He goes, Michael, good morning. I'm like, good morning. He goes, there's two things that you've done wrong. And remember, I'm just got to the second hole.
Yeah.
And I said, he said, you know what, Leo? I said, yes. I said, number one is I think I went across the fairway at number one. He said, yes, that's correct. Remember, this is my first day on this property. So I've went across the fairway at number one. I'm cutting approaches with wheels on the approach moor. I'm like, yeah, I went across the fairway. Like, yeah, don't go across the fairway, because he was the only person allowed on the fairways, unless you were cutting it, of course. And he said, right, number two. And I'm like, my lines weren't straight. Remember, I've checked, double checked, triple checked. He's like, nope, everything's great. Is it clean? Yep, everything was cleaned, Michael. I'm like, Bob, I don't know. He said, your shirt's untucked at the back. And I'm like, sorry? He's like, your shirt's untucked at the back. He says, make sure your shirt's untucked at all times. It tucked in at all times. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm 6'5", so shirts sometimes come out the back. But that was an introduction to we're a five-star property, and this is how you work here. There's an introduction to my first day at the job at Scioto Country Club.
And that attention to detail, Ian, is what these young people today, you know, are lacking. I mean, it's a small thing. His shirt was untucked. And this is where that standard stays with him forever. And I guarantee you, Mike still remembers that. And obviously he does, because he remembers it now. And this is what we're trying to achieve in what we do. But Mike, did that time benefit you? And then you went on from there. Where did you go after Scioto? I mean, the time was memorable, right? You did Muirfield as well.
Yeah, I did Muirfield Village, which was incredible when you're talking about attention to detail. I got, you know, very honored to work with Paul Latshaw there, who was magnificent. And also doing when before the tournament was going on, if there was a problem, I would go up with Bob to see Paul and listen to them two talking about turf was incredible. You know, I remember walking on one of the greens and Paul was like, he's like sniffing. He's like, Bob, can you smell that? I'm like, what is going on? You know? And Bob looks at me. He's like, oh yeah, I think there's a smell. He's like, yeah, I think there's a smell around the screen. He's like, Bob, oh. And their interactions were incredible. And I remember all of them to this day, but I remember doing all them events, and I go and do Muirfield Village, and the attention to detail for that tournament was absolutely incredible. Walking down fairways, throwing twigs, you know, not a twig, not a leaf inside the ropes. And I was lucky enough to, you know, go down to Bay Hill later. And, you know, you've got two superintendents working for the two best golfers that have ever lived almost. So, you know, getting them insights, you know, I'm like, Paul, what's it like to work for Jack Nicklaus? He's like, well, I know as soon as his plane lands, and I know when he's off the plane, I know where his car is. And then I can't remember the name of the superintendent. He's left now. He's from, I think he was from Utah or Idaho, Mike, down at Bay Hill. And he said that Mr. Palmer's the best person you could ever work for. He said he's an incredible man. You know, this is when he was still alive. So, yeah, you're getting insights not only from great places, but, you know, I had the opportunity to work with some incredible superintendents along the line. But after Scioto, I went down to Florida, to Lake Nona. My first day down at Lake Nona on the driving range, we had Ernie Els, Gray McDowell, who was US Open champion at the time, Yanni Son, who's number one in the world, lady golfer at the time, Trevor Immelman, Peter Hansen, Justin Rose,
Ian Poulter.
It was like a tour event. This, you know, you had all these guys on the driving range. So Lake Nona is part of that Isleworth group. You know, all the pros kind of always were there practicing and stuff like that. But an incredible property at Lake Nona. And again, 2 years ago, I went back to see the guys there. And I think Taylor Abbott is the superintendent there. Nick is the director of agronomy. So an incredible place to go down there and play, you know, use warm season grasses. You know, we're overseeding the Bermuda with Pua Triv. You know, everybody's having a heart attack in the UK if you're like, you're overseeding with Pua? I'm trying to get it out.
That's right.
Yeah. But so the thing about this, the theme of this, Ian, is that when you put somebody with great people, and for your listeners, Scioto Country Club is where Jack Nicklaus grew up. It was formed in 1916. They've had numerous major tournaments there, and it's located right here in Columbus, Ohio. And it was only 20 minutes from Muirfield Village, where Jack Nicklaus has the memorial tournament. So when he said, I went up to Muirfield, it was a matter of 20 minutes to go up there. And his super, Bob Becker, would take him up there, and he would volunteer up there. But he was based at Scioto Country Club. And matter of fact, they have the U.S. Senior Open next year on the 4th of July again, because it's 2026. So these are steeped in tradition courses, Ian. And this is what I try to do with people like Mike, is put them in with good people and just let them interact. And this kind of thing stays with them. And Mike, you went down then to Lake Nona, and who was there when you were there? Like, who rubbed off on you at Lake Nona? Who do you remember from being the super back then?
I had Carson Camps when I was down there. I used to call him the mad scientist,
yeah,
because he had a degree in finance. An incredible individual, young guy, hungry, wants to do well. And then he had Duffy over at Isleworth, because when I went down there, we had two guys at Bay Hill, we had two guys at Isleworth, and two guys at Lake Nona. So I kind of got together with them guys and said, listen, let's do a kind of study group where we can get all the ideas and everything that's happened at all the golf courses. And every Thursday night we'd get together and have a chat about what everybody was doing. So we got an even better experience, and the superintendents were on board with that and helped a lot with it. And we then integrated that into visits. So, you know, we went to Isleworth to see Duffy, we went to Bay Hill, and they had the Arnold Palmer obviously on. So yeah, it was an incredible experience working in Florida.
I don't want to interrupt the flow, Mike, but just how many was in that group?
There was six. There was two at Isleworth, two at Lake Nona, and two at Bay Hill.
Before you carry on, you've just touched on something there which I think is so important. So okay, our degree students are all online, right? They're all remote. Right?
Yeah.
But here, we would highly recommend that you pick up on that. You pick up on that. You find a group, because what you're missing, of course, is the group, you know, the group think in a campus, you know. Yeah. So you've got to recreate it for yourself. And the group size six is just about right. It's not too many. It's not too small. And then the activities you've described, the sharing of ideas, the regular contact, that's going to be so important if you're an online learner, that you're not out there alone. Doesn't have to be necessarily somebody on the program, but just somebody who's as passionate as you are about how things are being done and how things can be done better. I thought it was a great example I want to pick up on.
But I remember those meetings, Mike. It was very informal, and it was just getting together. What are you guys doing today? You know, what did you see out on the course? Well, we had a problem with this or that and everything. And there was no superintendents there or anything. It was just a bunch of young guys getting together, Mike. And you can expand on that.
It was great and bad at the same time, because Isleworth had Pythium root rot, right? So again, for the guys in the UK, you know, you might be worried about some fusarium, but you go somewhere like Florida and it is a petri dish of disaster, is the best way to describe it. And you know, in that climate with that humidity, you're yeah, always under attack. And yeah, they got Pythium root rot and lost half the greens. I remember going to see Duffy in his office, and he gave us an hour insight into Pythium root rot, you know, and we never get that unless we had them meetings where we sat down and talked and said, yeah, you know, what's going on at your place? You know, I remember Keegan Powell, who was at Isleworth, and Keegan's telling me, oh yeah, we got Pythium root rot. And I'm like, oh, I think I've seen something on that. And he goes back to meeting Seth when he's shown me a picture of Pythium attacking roots on a Bermuda root. And I'm like, we do see nothing like this in the UK.
Yeah.
But that gave me great insight to help me actually last year on my golf course.
Yeah.
So it was very kind of informal. Let's have a chat. Let's have a few beers and see what happens and what else are you doing at your course. But it's very important to keep that going. I'm still doing that with guys around the world to this day.
That is a good point, Ian. I'm glad you pointed that out. And that's your listeners, as they get into the degree program, you learn from each other. It's not just sitting down at a laptop at night. You get out there and don't be afraid to share the knowledge. And this is what they do, is they share. And, you know, we're very parochial back home. We all have mistakes. We all have issues, but you learn from each other and you help each other. And this is what we try to do in the program, is to encourage them to do that. I should give a little bit of background that Lake Nona and Isleworth are sister courses to the Albany Club over in the Bahamas. And Mr. Joe Lewis owns all of those clubs. And Mr. Joe Lewis is known behind the scenes for owning Tottenham Hotspur, the football club in England as well. So this is quite a consortium. And it's a very good consortium of courses that are out there around the world that many people don't know about this, maybe, Mike. So that was the relationship with Isleworth that was comfortable enough. You could go over and see Sean Duffy. Unfortunately, Sean Duffy has passed since then, but a very good guy and a very good mentor as well, Mike.
Yeah, Sean was great. I mean, some of the stuff he went through with us was very high end. And a guy, remember, at that point in time, is wondering if he's going to hold his job. You know, half the greens are gone. You know, you've got Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods is living there. Lee Jansen's living there. Charles Howell III is living there. I mean, this is a very, very big golf course with a lot of good people there. And he spent an hour with us going through the full process of how they were going to bring them back and what he was going to do to prevent it in the future. And he basically said, I missed one application of fungicide and it took out half my greens.
Yeah. So from there, Mike, where did you go after after Lake Nona?
From Nona, I was going to New Zealand and into the South Island.
I'm so enjoying this journey around the world. I really am. It's just an absolute joy to listen to this global career.
I've actually missed a point. So I'm going to give you the short version of this. There was talk maybe of me going to Medina for the Ryder Cup in 2012. I talked to Mike a little bit. He said maybe there's a point here. And then Bob Becker calls me up and he goes, Mike, the director of agronomy's moved on. One of my assistants has moved on. I need you to come back. I'm like, Bob, it's the Ryder Cup. He's like, I know it's the Ryder Cup, but I need you to come back. I need some help. Remember, this is the guy that come to me after 30 minutes about tucking the shirt in. And so, you know the answer. Obviously, I didn't go to the Ryder Cup. And it wasn't that memorable, that Ryder Cup at all. And so I go back to Syed Country Club. And basically work as one of his senior team for the next 6 months. And I went back to the 2016 US Open when I was in Indonesia. We'll get to that. And Bob has also called me about coming back in 26. I'm leaving to the South Island, Queenstown, to a place called The Hills. It's a very, very private golf course, an unbelievable golf course. And, As I think 2 days before I'm getting on the plane, I get an email to say, oh, by the way, there's no more visas being allowed into New Zealand. So I'm like, oh, you're kidding me. So I go back to Scotland. My father's not very well at the time, so he asked me to look after his business. So from the October to the January, I was stuck in Bonnie, Scotland. I think I actually helped Mike out with one of his trips to Scotland. I went and did a small presentation with Mike while I was back. But again, things happened for a reason. I was looking after 17 pubs and clubs in Scotland. So I'm doing P&Ls, I'm doing revenues, I'm doing operational costs. So I'm doing all that for each pub. So learning a lot about business, which again helps me out later in my career. And then I speak to Brendan Allen. I think Brendan Allen was the chairman of the New Zealand Greenkeepers Association at the time. Brendan Allen, brilliant, brilliant mind. I think he willed it. He was Royal Auckland before The Hills, I think, Mike.
Yeah. Brendan, great guy. So yeah.
I called him and I said, I still want to come because the New Zealand Open was in the February. And he's like, well, you're only going to have 6 weeks left on your contract. I'm like, it doesn't matter. I'm coming down and I'm going to come down and I'll do the tournament. He's like, well, he said, I kind of believe you only want to come down for a 6 weeks contract. He says, but you're more than welcome. So I flew Edinburgh to London, London to Singapore, Singapore to Sydney and Sydney to New Zealand, got into the South Island. And I'm going to tell you this, Ian, remember, I'm on a 6 week contract and I flew halfway around the world for this guy. So my first day on the job, he's like, oh, we need to pull some weeds out of one of the ponds. I'm like, oh, okay. So go to one of the ponds and it's just me and I'm pulling weeds out of the pond all day. So next day comes, he's like, Mike, how's the weeds coming? I'm like, oh, there's a little bit left. He goes, all right, we'll finish that off. So I'm pulling the weeds off and it's a Friday. So I said to him, I said, hey Brennan, there's some weed, and remember, this is me by myself. He's like, I said, hey, Brent, do you want me to do some overtime? I said, I'll finish this off before the weekend. He's like, all right, no problem. So I pulled all the weeds out, put it into the back of the workman, took that away. Saturday morning come in, and he's like, oh, there's some weeds on the hill. It's 17, which is a beautiful par 5. And he's like, can you take the weeds out? I'm like, yep, no problem. So I'm like pulling weeds out on the side of a hill. And then the next day he brings me in. He goes, right, have a look around the golf course, come in and tell me what you think about it. So I went around the golf course. I said, well, you've got 17 signature holes. He's like, right, which one is not a signature hole? I'm like, hole 16 isn't the best. I said, it doesn't sit with the rest of the golf course. He said, oh, we're going to upgrade that one in about 2 years' time. But the point was, and me and Brendan have never spoke about this, but what he did was he wanted to see if I had work ethic. Remember, I've traveled halfway around the world, and he stuck me in a pond to pull out weeds. Yeah. I didn't complain. I put my head down. I got the work done. I pulled everything out. And from that day forward, he put a lot of effort into me and gave me a lot of scope while I was there, put me in charge of teams straight away. And, you know, he wanted to extend my contract down in New Zealand after the New Zealand Open. But I got a call to go to Dubai. But again, it's about that work ethic. When you're going to work for these top guys, they're gonna test you. And they're going to see what your work ethic is like. They're going to see, is he a complainer or does he put his head down and get the job done?
Ian, this is very important for young people, your listeners, to hear that. It's unbelievable. I mean, you know, the key to where he made the impression, the test was clearly there. I hear it every day. You know, these young people, they see this and they wilt. And they're like, I'm not going to be treated like that. I've flown halfway around the world. No, Mike's like, well, listen, there's some more weeds and you want me to finish them. This is the attitude that gets you success. It's not about the weeds. It's about the principle of it and doing that. And that's what's really, really important today is if people see that and you get beyond that, the guy earns so much respect as a result of it. It's very, very important today. And I think this is what we don't stress enough to young people is that this is part of the business. You earn that respect. And from there on, it was plain sailing. And you have to know that side of the business. You have to see that, Ian, when you come through and do that.
Well, you've read my mind there, Mike, because I was going to ask the question, you know, when you go into these let's call them five-star venues, high-performance teams, you know, what expectations do they have of a young person? Well, yeah, I think you've answered that, you know, work ethic. But I was going to ask you that. Is there anything that, you know, you're going to advise somebody who goes into maybe never been in one of these high performance teams before, bit nervous, you know, they're coming from a, you know, community golf club in Sunderland. Well, yeah, what advice are you going to give to them to, you know, settle in quickly in such an environment?
Yeah, well, I think it's a very simple one. I think in all of our lives, we know what we like and we know what we're striving to become. Well, I hope most of us are. The young people maybe don't know yet. But if you're going to go and test yourself, then before you've stepped foot on the plane, you have to understand that you're going to be tested and you're going to go to places and you're going to have to do things that are going to get you outside your comfort zone. But you ain't going to grow if you don't go outside your comfort zone. And there's nothing wrong with it. If you want to, you know, stay where you are and just do the general things, that's fine. But if you want to go and push your career and see how far you can take it, then you need to make that decision before you get out there. But if you want to push yourself and be the best version of yourself, or, you know, you want to take all of that experience, come back home and put that into your career, then before you've took any step, you need to understand that there's some minimum requirements going to go on to do this kind of work.
Yeah, we call it stretch. I mean, we call it stretch.
Yeah.
How much do you want to stretch?
Dubai next?
Dubai. So I'm trying to give you the fast version so we can get through it. I go to Dubai. I'm working at Al Badia Golf Club, which is Dubai Festival City, right next to the airport. It's doing 60,000 rounds. It's a Robert Trent Jones design. And I'm working with who's still a very good friend of mine. I speak to him. He's working in Saudi Arabia, Paddy. And hot Irishman and a Geordie. It's a great mix. Obviously, for the show, there wasn't a lot of English getting spoke. There wasn't a lot of nice words exchanged. But we got through it. And they said to me, right, I want you to drive around the golf course and just check stuff. I'm like, what? I'm like, I'm an assistant. I need to spray it now. He's like, you're not doing any of that. He's like, just go and drive and come back. Right. Again, just go out, just drive and come back. So I go out the first day. We have about 40 workers. Most of them are from the Philippines. I'm trying to learn a little bit of Filipino to get me through. And after the first day, I go in his office and I'm like, okay, now I understand. And he started laughing. He said, well, that was quicker than most. I said, yeah, if you don't check, they're not doing any work. He's like, that's how it is. Yep. And I was like, right, okay. So luckily, I'd worked with the Hispanic workforce in the US in different cultures from around the world at this point. So it really helped me. And Dubai, very difficult, you know, 5 million liters of water a night. It's 50 degrees. And it's like, it's basically like walking into an oven when you come out of a building. And one thing from Dubai I would tell everybody who's listening is they had the Middle East Greenkeepers Association, which was run by Mark Tuplin and Craig Haldane, two giants of our industry for me. I think both of them are actually working in Saudi Arabia. I'm sure Mike will correct us if I'm wrong, but they ran that, and all the superintendents would come together and the assistant superintendents would come together. And again, what's the problems? What's going on? That get the vendors to come in and talk. There was a very much a community feel in Dubai with the top guys, lending machinery, lending staff to each other. I was very lucky to go and work the DP World Race to Dubai final. I did some, I changed the hulls with one of the guys there and Mark when Mark was there. So my time in Dubai was great. And that was the first time I'd seen superintendents really talking to each other. You know, obviously we had Bob and Paul Acho in Ohio, but that group of people, you know, helping each other out, you know, you're overseas as an expat, and this is my first kind of, I'm going into Asia, I'm going into lands new where English isn't a spoken language, and to have that great community there is very, very important.
Yeah, once again, community, yeah? Community of learner, but that's a big one. You know, you had a small one, there's a bigger one. Absolutely essential. Yeah, keep going, Mike, because I have a question coming, but keep going. Dubai,
right?
Then
so I'm in Dubai and I'm ambitious, right? And yep. It's the 28th of May and it's my birthday, and I have a meeting with Robin Evans from Troon Golf, and Troon are very big in the Middle East area. And I went to see him and spoke about if there's any opportunity coming up, because I'd like to take that next step to be superintendent. I think this is maybe he's around 2013 or 14. And he's like, oh, we have a position in India if you're interested. And I'm like, right, well, what is it? And he's like, right, well, there's a superintendent position in India. We've just put a new GM in. The golf course has no water, and we have multiple issues with the irrigation system. Are you interested in that? And what I loved about Robin was very straight, you know. And he's like one shot of the head, not two shot in the stomach. He's like, he just laid it out to me, and of course I said yes. I'm like, okay, I'll take that on, you know. There seems to be multiple problems I can get my teeth into. So then I was off to Bangalore in India, and working with Troon Golf out there. So that was brilliant. Obviously, it's a golf management company. The agronomy side of it, they have a big team. They have a big support team. And what was great about going to India is I was able to think on my feet. I was able to come up with things that they would normally not do. The Troon agronomy style, they want to keep everything the same. This is what we think. This is what we want to do. But because I was in that situation where we didn't have a lot of water, I said, I want to bring in a moisture meter. I said, if we've got no water, then a moisture meter might help, instead of, you know, looking at southern facing slopes to see what dries out the fastest. So I did 2 years in India, and we eventually got the water to the golf course. I was using local villagers pumping in boreholes, and You know, I had somebody monitoring irrigation all night, and we had a generator, diesel generator on our pump station because the electric would go out, which was okay for the pump station, believe it or not. But if you're in the house on a treadmill training for marathon and the electric goes out, there's a couple of bumps on your head when that happens. But I could be on the call for another 3 days to tell you about India.
Mike, the thing that we're learning here is that you never say no. You know, you said yes. The guy was basically throwing the stuff in front of you. And most people would say, no, I'm not interested. You know, this is for young people today, is the doors open that you don't know exist. You never knew that door would open for India. I mean, this is what I'm saying to young people today, is put yourself out there. Don't be afraid to go out. I mean, it's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to fail. And this is what you've done. You've gone out there and not been afraid to go out there and adapt. I mean, you're getting locals to watch the irrigation at night. You have to stand up and be convincing. Now, I should tell people, this guy is 6'5". And he's a dominating figure when he's in India, you can imagine, in that situation. But, you know, Ian, the importance of this is, like, in New Zealand, you put yourself with good people. I keep saying this. You put yourself around good people, and then you go on and you diversify into a management company. For people that don't know this, in the UK, Troon is one of the largest golf management companies in the world. I think they manage over 400 golf courses around the world, Mike. And this is Robin Evans. He's the chief agronomist for the Middle East and Asia. So you're talking to the right people. You're putting yourself in front of the right people, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, like, I looked at that opportunity and I thought, what a place to learn. You know, what a place to learn. Because the irrigation system has got multiple problems. There's no water. And, you know, this was a great opportunity with, you know, 240 villas around it. And we were building a new 12-hole complex at another housing community. So I got the chance to be project manager on that, did a full growing on a 12-hole development, you know, kind of overseeing that. And it's doing really well. In Bangalore, Gulfshire is, I think it's been voted best golf course in India the last 3 years. So yeah, I was talking to somebody in the industry the other day, and they were asking me about electrical issues with Toro satellites. And I was telling them that we would put a quarter amp fuse on every line going into the satellite box, because it would blow up every night because the red ants and termites would eat through the communication wire. And then the monsoon rain would hit, and then, like, it would be like, and all the heads would be coming up and satellites are blowing up. I mean, it was incredible. You know, every day there was an issue. You know, I had 40 villagers in my office going mad because one of the staff wanted his job back. It was a life lesson for sure, but it was great working with Troon. And I think I'm probably one of the only guys that have ever left Troon, because after 2 years, I asked what the next step was. They didn't have anything on the radar, so I took the plunge and I moved down to Bali in Indonesia to a golf course that is no longer at the moment. They are trying to get it going again. But Nirwana Bali with Pan Pacific Hotels was top 50 in the world. It was called the Pebble Beach of Asia. It was an incredible, incredible property. And I work with IMG down there, so I got to work with the guys with IMG. Chris May, who's now the superintendent, is it PGA West? I think he is in LA, Mike, maybe down there, I think now, yeah. Chris May.
Yeah.
You know, work with Paul Burley and people like that from IMG. So, yeah, I went down to Bali. I had 120 staff. For the people listening, imagine having 120 staff. I could have done with 200 at Bali Nirwana, but I had 120 staff under my wing there.
And this is the progression, Ian. I mean, you think about that. You know, you come out of Newcastle and you tell somebody you're going to be managing 120 staff. How do you get to that level? But it's one day at a time, and you have to be consistent. You have to know who's around you. You got to know the good people around you. You got to be very fair to people, learning and respecting the local cultures as well. I know Nirwana Bali very well, actually, because Eamon McCarthy might have been there before you. And being sensitive to the cultures and being that adaptable is what it's all about. And that's what makes for a global greenkeeper. And Ian, this is a great advert for your degree. This profession can take you around the world. I mean, I bet you've lost track of how many countries he's been to already, you know, but Bali, two years in Bali. What was your summation at that time? Was that successful? Was it good?
Yeah, the owning group spoke to me and they said that they wanted me to stay to oversee. There was a O'Neill's project going on in Lido, which is in the main island north of Jakarta. Yeah. And then they were like, can you oversee both of them? And they also told me that they were thinking of not closing it after the changes that I'd made to upgrade the property. And with a kind of heavy heart, I know how things work. I know that it was going to take a long time for them to kind of establish both properties and an opportunity to come up with IMG to go and build a new golf course in Nar Jontium, which is kind of near Pattaya in Thailand. So I made the jump to Thailand to be the growing superintendent at Chee Chan Golf Resort, which is in Pattaya.
Yeah, and that's the thing, Ian. Nirwana Bali did close, and the Lido Club did open, and Ernie Els did open it, and Mick Pasco is the superintendent there now. So they did open that course, and it's doing very well, actually. It's a Trump-managed property. But so Thailand, so... You know, people always talk about how do you get into Asia, but you got into Asia, yeah. And that's the thing, is the culture of Asia. You adapted very well, Mike. Talk about that, how difficult it is to get into somebody like Thailand and deal with the culture there.
Luckily, I don't think my wife is going to listen to this podcast, but it's pretty difficult when you're working in Asia. Remember that. I try and explain this. I recently went down to Australia and I spoke at the Victorian Golf Superintendents Association about 2 weeks ago. And some of the questions that were asking me was about, you know, what's the culture like? You know, do people really push? And I'm like, this is the job. I haven't got people knocking my door down saying, I want to learn more. I want to do more. It's not like that. This is normally just a job for people coming out working on a golf course. So you got to wake up every day, you know, going into work as if it was your first day. And, you know, there can be a lot of frustrations involved in it. But I think that's part of growing as an individual, knowing that your patience is going to be tested. Your abilities are going to be tested. And you got to remember that you're a visitor in these countries, too. You know, I think coming from Newcastle helps. I think we're a very open kind of in our culture is being from the northeast of England. You know, we were a welcoming bunch, and I think that's helped me a lot, you know, with my upbringing, because you have to learn to understand people, you know. So I've done a lot of work with the CMAE, which is the Club Managers Association of Europe, and worked on knowing myself and knowing ways to get the job done, but ultimately understanding that the culture differences are always going to be there. And when you think you've cracked it, that's when you're in trouble, because you've never cracked it. And every day is difficult, but it has its rewards when you see the accolades that come with it and the hours that you put in.
But you moved then from down in Pattaya. And when did you get into the club manager's career path education program, Mike? And was that earlier or later? Or what drove you to do that, like to move to that level?
Yeah, this is, you know, probably for listeners, you know, growing up as I did, you know, in the late 80s and 90s, most head greenkeepers dislike massively members and committee members. But for me, it was more, I went to a Amata Spring Country Club, which has held a lot of big tournaments. And I went as superintendent. And as the GM was moving on, I worked with a great guy, David Townend there. And when he moved on, as I said, the chairman said, can you step up and just look after the golf side? Because I know you have the golf side knowledge. I said, yeah, there's no problem with that. I can do that. And then they come to see me after about a month and said, listen, we want you to take everything on. And I was like, if I take everything on, then I have to go back to school. because I want to know that I know that I know what I'm doing. So they said, that's fine. Anything you want to do, you can do. So I went through the Asian Golf Federation and started there. And then I got in touch with Toby at the Club Managers Association of Europe. And then I did my first MDP, which is a management development program. Actually, in the hospital as my first son was born. And I was at the bottom of the bed when my son was being born on a call like this during COVID. So it's been a journey. But 4 years in, I got my CCM, which is a certified club manager, because it was a challenge again. You know, I think you're learning that from me. For me, it was always, you know, you can get to the top in your profession or near the top in your profession. You might think, you know, but, you know, most of the guys I've worked with have probably forgot more than I know. But it was another chance to push the envelope. You know, can I become a better version of myself? Is there another string to a bow? And again, going back all them steps, you know, I worked with my father. I understand business. And then stepping into that dual role was just simply, it's just a lot of punishment. You know, I'm going to be very straight with your listeners. You know, it's not easy. You know, running a golf course at the magnitude of what I have, it you know, a modest spring country club, is a job in itself. I was working 14 hours a day when I was superintendent. I actually went in to see my purchasing manager 2 weeks ago, and I said, can you purchase me an extra 4 hours a day, please? I said, 24 is not enough. And he started laughing. But with anything else, you know, the challenges bring rewards. And again, I've been able to do my CCM. I've been exposed to even more people around the world. Now I know superintendents. Now I know GMs. I've had the privilege of meeting these people and networking with them. And it's really helping me.
For the purpose of the listeners, tell us a little bit about Armada Spring, because it's a long history and it's a big club, Mike.
Yeah, Armada Spring was established in 2005, and the first thing they did, well, it was built to bring championship golf to the Kingdom of Thailand, and the first thing they did was they brought in Lee Schmidt and Brian Curley, and Lee Schmidt was one of the head designers for Nicklaus. So, you know, Lee come in and he's built an incredible golf course. And again, I've worked at some of the best golf courses in the world. Let me tell you that the layout of Armada Spring Country Club is incredible. It's a great golf course. It has Asia's only floating green. I'm sure if you look it up on the internet, you'll see it. I'm currently in the process of building another one, which is costing us over £1 million pounds. And that's something that keeps me awake at night in between all of the kids. But Armada Spring brought in the Royal Trophy. So the Royal Trophy was Europe versus Asia. So Sebiano Ballesteros was the captain of that. And that ran from 2006 to 2013. So although Armada kind of let it go in 2009, you know, the old Royal Trophy pictures are incredible. I talked to Thomas Bjorn about it at a recent tournament. I presented him with a picture, and the team, one of the first teams, was Thomas Bjorn, Henrik Stenson, Graham McDowell, Nick Faldo, Ian Woosnam, Seve, and the Paul McGinley. So, I mean, it was incredible, the teams that were playing in that. And then we did the Thai Championships, which ran from 2011 to 2014. And people who played in that were like Bubba Watson, Sergio Garcia. It was the who's who. It was in conjunction with the PGA Tour. So Lee Westwood won it twice. Sergio Garcia won it. Charles Schwartzel won it. So, yeah, an incredible group of winners. And then 2018, when I went, we did the Armada Friendship Cup, which was the first event with male and female golfers competing in the same event for the same team. And we had amateur golfers. So the amateur golfer for Thailand when I did it was Adia Titikul, who's I think currently world number one. She practices at our place a lot, so I've, you know, kind of watched her grow up at Armada. She's an incredible golfer. We also did the Asia Pacific Amateur Championship, which was great.
How many staff do you have now, Mike, at the club?
I have 150 full-time staff, and I have 200 part-time staff.
Wow. Wow. That's some crew. That's some crew.
Just on that, Mike, I've noticed on your LinkedIn page, you describe a passion of yours is bringing everybody together, you know, bringing teams together. But you said something that really crosses paths with this podcast, is that we've noticed that there are clubs out there where the stakeholders, if you like, aren't on the same page. The golfers' expectations are different to the owners' expectations. The owners are frustrated with the management team. The management team, you know, aren't necessarily working together. And you seem to express something to us, which we really picked up on, is that you're passionate about bringing all those stakeholders together at a club. So it's a successful club, but it's a happy club because the owners feel the same way as about the members, and the members feel the same way about the staff. Is that what you're achieving out there in Asia? Because we're trying to find cases where people have managed to do that.
It's exceedingly difficult. And what I always say is, you know, a phrase that that I've always grew up with is the monkey on the back, right? So you've got to find out what the monkey is, right? And this is kind of how I always describe it. You know, you have that member who's always complaining, he's always complaining, they're always complaining. You've got to find out what the real reason is why they're upset. And you've got to dig deep into that. And that takes a little bit of, you've got to have a little bit of knowledge into extracting information without extracting information. And what that sounds like is, and I know we got Mike here, it sounds a little Irish, but what it means is that when you have somebody that is complaining or somebody that's not aligned, there's a reason for that. And you've got to find the right way to find out what that reason is. And to do these kind of things, what I always do is I talk to, of course, group talk is fine, but I like to talk to people individually and as many individuals as I possibly can, especially in my job. So like my board is some of the most successful people in Thailand. You know, I've got like CEOs of BMW, CEOs of Ricoh. Like these are incredibly intelligent individuals. So I've got to individually talk to them all. You can't side with one and not with another. You know, this is one of the great things about Thailand. They have a thing called not losing face, which is, you know, I'm going into board meetings. There's no shouting. There's no disagreements in board meetings and anything like that. It's just a general conversation. All the work is done before you get there. You know, any board meeting I'm going to, all the decisions are already made, you know. Because they talk to each other individually. And that's something I'm taking on board. And that goes with your staff too. You know, the person that's not turning up for work all the time or the person that's late all the time, go and have a chat with them, get a coffee, go and sit with them and ask them if everything's okay. How can you help them? You know, I think it's very important that you have to understand your staff because we have perceptions of what we think. You know, for me, I'm working with a guy who breaks his ankle on a Saturday morning and cuts all the greens and rakes bunkers, even though he's got a broken ankle. You know, these are the guys I've worked under. So you can tell my work ethic is pretty hard. But, you know, 75% of the workforce is millennial now. You know, it doesn't mean that these guys aren't good workers. It just means that they have a different perception about how work is done and about the process behind it compared to somebody like me. So I have to understand them more. So one of my main jobs as a general manager, but I think even as a head greenkeeper or anybody, is you have to understand your staff and you have to spend time understanding them and make some compromises. Like my superintendent, Carson Camp at Lake Nona, taught me, give somebody enough rope but not enough to hang themselves. And that always stuck with me because he's like, I want you to do well. I want you to be a superintendent. So I'm going to let you go out and spray, but I'm going to let you spray some back tee boxes with a little bit of urea, right? And then you'll progress to spraying something harder and then spraying the greens because I want you to learn and I want you to understand it. So my thing is bringing teams together is the hardest thing in the world. And it's a lonely place being a leader. You know, I've went through a lot of hardship over the last 2 years with things happening at my club. It's not all sunshine and rainbows. And there's a lot of nights where I don't sleep. There's a lot of times where I'm trying to figure it out if I know the right stuff anymore. And there's going to be failures. But with any failure, it gives you the opportunity to get back up. And the only failure you can ever have is doing the same thing twice and thinking it was going to change. So I think it's imperative that one of the lessons that gets learned is you have to understand people. Put your ego to one side, put your own perception to one side, and try and listen to somebody and really listen to somebody. We've got two ears for a reason and one mouth. And although many people will tell you that I rattle on, I do tend to listen more than I talk, believe it or not.
Fantastic, Mike. Thank you very much for that insight about bringing people together, about the individual one-to-one. I think everybody can learn from that and maybe apply it, because I know it's an issue across, you know, a whole range of clubs and organizations. And then, so appreciate that. And the second one about listening, of course. Yeah. We don't do enough of that. I know I don't. So one last observation, if I'm more of an observation before we let you get back to your family, because we've taken up so much of your time. And by the way, we would like your good lady to listen to this podcast. We would. And by the way, all our friends as well. This is a very important point about such programs as the Ohio State is people coming out of that high performance environment, as I call it, and those great venues and those great mentors, and coming out of it and at risk of maybe going on a bit of a downer if they come straight back home. I think that everybody's going to be like that. And of course, they're not. They've gone into a whole different working environment, a whole different culture, a whole different country, and they're coming back out. And I think you've answered the question brilliantly in the sense of, you only go into these programs if you want to grow as much as you've, you know, discussed today. And if you come out of Mike's program, how qualified you are to take on challenges and to go into problem situations, to go into the places like Bangalore and, you know, where they've got no water, and Asia, where golf is, you know, a developing sport, you're now qualified to take those challenges on. So I'm a great fan of Stephen Covey, and he always talks about, you know, begin with the end in mind. So it's almost like you're doing this program in order to prepare yourself to go on to the next big challenge, which you've beautifully described. It's been so entertaining and so educational. And I think that's the answer to the guys who are worried about coming out of the program and going back. But you're not going back. You'll go forward, but you'll have to be prepared to maybe, you know, go to new locations, go to new cultures, go to new problem sets. But the world is so full of challenges and opportunities where you can have an adventure like you've described, isn't it? I mean, I think golf is so full of opportunity. There's so many countries developing this sport, and these programs and these education initiatives we take on are meant to prepare these young people for that.
Yeah, I'll give you some quick insights. Tyneside Golf Club, which I just told you about, I went down to play golf there with the head greenkeeper. And I said to him, I said, hey, as we were playing the fourth hole, and I said, hey, I says, remember what you said to me here? And he looked at me and he goes, oh, I knew you were going to say this. So when I was an apprentice, we were digging a hole by hand. And again, Mike told you, I'm, you know, 6'5", and I'm at the bottom of it, and I'm like just covered in mud, right? And he popped his head over the top and he looked at me and he goes, you're worth every penny of that $12.50 a day. That's how much I was making, right? And I reminded him of it. And he goes, I can't believe I said that to you. He says, what a motivator. I said, no, you were a motivator. I said, because I took it as motivation. It didn't dishearten me. I'm like, right, I'll show you, you know? So, and then he also told me, so, you know, I remember Stephen Cram. I think Stephen Cram's up at Archerfield now. I think he's the superintendent up at Archerfield. And I remember when I went to interview with him at Slaley Hall, and he looked at my grades from school, and he looked at it and he goes, why do you want to be a greenkeeper? He said, you've got great grades, you know. I said, well, because when I went on work placements, because I did advanced science, I said, when I went on work placements and I'm sitting in a lab coat with a Bunsen burner, I said, I was not interested. I said, but as soon as I come onto a golf course and it's part of me is a passion for golf, I said, this is what I want to do. And he's like, I know, but there's not that much money on it. You know, there's not a lot of money in it. I said, and I said at the time, I'm like, it's not all about money. I said, I'd rather live my life doing something that I like doing rather than live my life hating every day going to work and not fulfilling what I want inside. Again, money is important. We all know money is important. Money is the end product of hard work. That's maybe my generation speaking, but you've got to work hard to get to the top because there's a lot of people, you know, you'll see 100 CVs. Michael deal with millions of people trying to get in touch with his program. And then he's got to look in that. And then he's got to identify some people. And how are you going to identify some people? Well, you're going to have to speak to references and people who are working with them. But, you know, to give you some further insight for your listeners is doing the Ohio State program, again, was something I wanted to do at 19. I did it later, but I did that. I worked with Troon. I worked with IMG. I went to the Club Managers Association of Europe and did my CCM. I'm doing my MBA now, and I'm bringing up, I've lost count of the kids, Mike. I think there's four of them. I think the wife wants one more. Like, I'm coming in from work and I have these four kids who are draining all the energy out of me. Let's be honest. And I love the challenge of having to bring these guys up. My son is telling my assistant on the golf course that he's top dressing with too much sand the other night, and he's four. And my assistant looked at me and I nodded. I'm like, he's right. So there's always going to be challenge in life, but if there's no challenge in life, then what's the point of going through it? And I'm a big reader. Stephen Covey's stuff is great. The Way of the Seal is another great book for the guys listening. And again, as you move around the world, I'll tell you this. You know, you talked about the 5-year plan. Richie McCraw was the captain of the All Blacks. And there's a movie coming. There's a movie that's out already called Chasing Great. And in it, he said, when I was a kid, I sat with my uncle. And my uncle said, what do you want to do? He's like, I want to play for the All Blacks. And he said, do you want to play for the All Blacks or do you want to be the best All Black that's ever lived? And Richie McCraw, for the rest of his life, would write down his plan. And at the bottom, he would always write, be the greatest ever All Black on the bottom. And his first time as a kid sitting with his uncle, he wrote it on a napkin that he still has, I think. And he wrote at the bottom, the greatest ever All Black. And I'm a great believer in, you know, if you dream it, if you think it, if you push towards it, it'll happen. It's a reality. I think Jim Carrey said he wrote a check for $15 million. He put it in his wallet. And then when he did The Mask, that movie, if you remember from the 90s, he got $15 million. So you got to dream big. You got to put yourself out there and make yourself uncomfortable. It's worth every hour of every minute you spend in a pond pulling weeds or laying 100,000 bricks at Scioto Country Club. As Mike would know, there's another story for another time, Ian. But I think that's my two cents for you.
We're going to leave it on a high unless Mike wants to ask anything else. Do you, Mike?
No, this is excellent, Ian. I wanted to get this story out there because it's not just this podcast. Let's try to take advantage of this and stay in touch with Mike McKenna because he's giving his time and he's gone down to Australia. He was down in Melbourne talking. I heard from probably six people in the room down there, by the way, Mike, that they were so inspired by your story. So, Ian, if there's people out there that want to reach out to him, if there's people out there that want to hear more, you know, he's a great example of where you can go from being a greenkeeper to being a general manager. It's it's the story in between that matters, and it's the doors. Ohio State is only a small part of this. I mean, he had that drive and that passion before I met him. It's just putting people in the right places and giving them the opportunity to travel. I mean, there's a lot of networking involved in that we haven't talked about, but this is something, Ian, we should take advantage of going down the road in the future because you're trying to grow these guys, right? You're trying to grow general managers like Mike McKenna. Is that correct?
Absolute. Absolute. One of the things I want to call this part one, if I may, Mike. You know, we look forward to part two, because it's been inspirational and it was so many insights. And the thing we want to cover, I think, is dig a little bit deeper about how you've made that transition. We didn't really cover that. You know, how have you made that transition from the golf course into general manager? Because that's our curriculum. That's our curriculum. And there's a lot of guys who are at that point. They've been course managers for maybe 10 years or more. And it's not as if they're bored, but they are, as you described, you know, they're looking for that next challenge. They're looking for that next step. And that to follow in that path is something we would maybe want to encourage them to do it. Why? Because the golf course is the number one asset of any club. And you want somebody running the whole club that understands that asset. Now, how much of an understanding they need will always be debatable, but that's our curriculum, really. That's what we're trying to do, is to get people either into that role that you have, or encouraging the people who do have that role to let the people get on with their expertise and not block that expertise.
Yeah.
But that's a subject for another day.
Okay.
Because you have to get back to the wife and kids, and Mike has to get back to his job, and I've got a golf course waiting for me out there. Thank you, Mike. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mike O'Keefe, as well, for the introduction and for you know, helping me chair this, Mike. Absolutely superb again. Thanks for listening, and see you next time on The First Tee.